I would think that changes in the city's building code. So if you're doing a significant renovation or building systems alterations, there will be new performance standards that you would have to meet, whether it's boiler installation, HVAC systems, windows, what have you. Legislation and policy could also, besides providing the stick of you must, provide the carrot and the incentive of different kind of incentive programs, grants, tax rebates, you know, cash for your clunker is going to take out those old air conditioners and put in a newer system. There could be incentive programs there as well, and that's all before us.
Yes, here.
It depends on the client. We have some clients who are really, really involved in process, and PPL is a great example for that. I think PPL is the Pennsylvania Power and Light Company or something like that, an energy trading company. So there's a huge investment in it. So in a way, they helped us guide what their goals were. They said, you know, give us a really great green building. We want LEED Gold, whatever it was that they said. When the client is that involved, we definitely take them through the whole process to make sure that they know exactly what they're getting and that they're aware of it. The other thing that we tend to do, and this is particularly with institutions, is that we work with the facilities people very early on in the design stage, especially for life cycle costing and for maintenance issues. When we find that when we get maintenance involved and, you know, a student body involved and stuff like that, they tend to really have a stronger engagement with the building that goes beyond our involvement. And what we're trying to do as well is to go back to especially the school and have the students do a post-occupancy monitoring of the buildings and see, you know, did it work? You know, what are the things we could improve on and all that kind of stuff. So I think really engagement with them really early in the design phase really helps.
I was just going to ask you kind of a follow-on question there, which is, when you engage the client or the client has engaged you, is the greenness of the project really driven from the senior most manager, or is it kind of lobbied for by middle managers to senior management?
It's a little bit of both. Like, we've definitely had a project where the donor whose name was going on the building said, I'm not going to give you this money unless it's green. So there's that kind of level. But there's definitely, on an institutional level, students lobbying for it on that level are also getting it too. So it's a little bit of everybody. But often it only takes one person.
I actually have another follow-up question onto that. Specifically within the green, have you guys found, is there a certain area that people are really interested in promoting, whether it's energy efficiency or, I mean, is there a specific aspect that they seem to be more interested in?
That's kind of difficult because I think the things that we promote a lot, like we've been stressing, are the simple things that you can do, because those are really often the ones that make the biggest difference. But the things that people really get interested in are often things like photovoltaics or other elements that you can see, you can touch, you know are there, and things that are really a part of the image of the building. So there's always a trade-off. You know, you have to have kind of unglamorous things like really efficient chillers, and then you also have to have some things that make the building exciting and make people want to go and see those things, like a green roof or like photovoltaic panels or a water treatment system that's included. So it has to be a mixture of both, but people typically get excited about those things that you can really understand just by looking at them.
Yes, David.
Not
Oh, David, I ask myself that question all the time. When will it become part of the general building codes? I don't have an answer to that, but I would like to focus on what it will take to get there. Not every development, not every tenant, not every renter will need to feel that the building that they're occupying has, I love your term, green bling. To use your term, David, I think many buildings will probably do very well if the green is a transparent green. Buildings are comfortable. Commercial tenants want to renew their leases. They're willing to pay higher rents. That all of those kinds of things will be incentives. But as part of really pushing the rock, the legislative and the political rock up the hill, one of the things we do need, and again, I'll quote Lord Kelvin, about the importance of measurement. We too often do not know, once a green building is designed, constructed, built, commissioned, and then the doors open, how those buildings actually perform. Do they perform as well as the design work? With the New York State green building tax incentive, we don't know any of the results. We in the public sector, we in the civic sector, we in the sustainable finance and design and construction world need to be asking those questions, need to be getting answers. And then we'll start seeing more of general standards.
Yes, here.
Yes, and that's something that we try to incorporate as much as possible. It's much more difficult than just measuring the energy that the building will actually use. But life cycle assessment for materials is a very important part of assessing the sort of quantitative effect of the building on the environment. And the trade-off that you have to look at is that if a building is going to last 100 years, it's probably more important to reduce the amount of energy that it uses per year, because that will make a huge difference in the end, and a much greater one than the initial impact of the materials and the resources that go into making the materials. But with that thought in mind, some of the best ways to reduce the impact of materials are simply getting materials that are from closer. So for instance, the LEED system that I was talking about, one of the categories of credits, the materials category, relates entirely to recycled materials, to regionally produced materials, to FSC-certified woods, and all of those things are really important in making the impact of the material quantity of the building less great on the environment. So the more you can use a recycled material, the fewer virgin resources you have to use, and the more you can use a regional material, the less fuel is used to transport that material across the country.
To comment, though, I mean, there is this notion of a toxic heritage that, you know, even though a building may be standing, 100 years on average, that what strikes me, what's a really particularly salient example is DDT. You know, it was a pesticide, it was banned, I believe, in the 1970s, if not earlier, maybe even earlier. And the CDC in Atlanta has established or developed better and better techniques to measure chemical residue in human blood. So they take random samples from various different blood banks across the USA and determine, you know, what are the concentrations of various different toxic chemicals in the blood in today's population. And even though DDT has been banned for several decades, they have found residue of DDT, a metabolite, i.e., a substance which has metabolized in the human body, or been metabolized by the human body, I should say, DDE, they find concentrations in young children in the age of 0 to 5, and it turns out the concentrations are highest in the young children. So that there is a residue. So it might be nice to say, gee, you know, maintenance of a 100-year-old or potentially a 100-year-old building is important. And I would not argue with that. But we have to think long-term in terms of the substances that we use to construct these buildings.
Well, that's pretty compelling argument. Way in the back, yes.
Yeah, at the moment, we just got our audit. This is like a month or two old. But what we've decided to do is we've decided in all our future contracts with people to really specifically list the meetings, especially for clients that are really far away. So we've cut down the number of those kind of meetings and tried to make the meetings such that we would be meeting more than kind of, we would be having more than one meeting in a day. So if we were going to make that trip out to somewhere, we would be meeting, you know, for the whole day or whatever it was. We've also started to try to take trips together, you know, take cabs together, take planes together and stuff like that, so that cuts it down a little bit. But we haven't been able to afford the video conferencing yet, so that's the next thing that we're going to try to do, because it's been really difficult. So for now, it's still conference calls.
Yes, here outside.
I mean, most of these substances are regulated in some form in various different of the EPA regs, especially the Clean Air Act, Clean Air Act amendments, 1990. I will now speak as non-EPA, and I mentioned earlier that the Europeans are moving ahead with a very rigorous chemical testing program, the REACH program. I don't know what the acronym stands for right now, but I apologize. REACH, there it is. It really is spelled that way. And the approach in Europe is much more, you know, precautionary. So rather than produce all these new chemicals and launch them onto the market and regulate after the fact, which is our approach in the USA, you know, they're trying to prevent the problems a priori. So this is my non-EPA hat, you know, or my citizen, concerned citizen attitude. I don't think the EPA is doing enough, but as I know full well, sitting inside, you know, we are captive, we are stuck, as we are an administrative organ, and we can only do certain things under certain administrations. I don't know if that answers your question sufficiently.
Sounds like she'll be promoted soon.
So vote.
Are there other questions out there? Yes, right here. Is that before or after the 17,000 that got cut last week?
Has there been any kind of internal push to do a carbon audit or to kind of look at what you guys are doing and see if there's any internationally with regards to sustainability?
Well, absolutely. Citigroup has been one of the founding signatories of the Equator Principles, which is a global compact of financial institutions that abide by certain human rights, environmental, and governance standards. They then have issued certain policies. One of our most recent policies, in fact, is around climate change. We have done carbon audits, and we have ourselves kind of, we have a significant but not extraordinary footprint in terms of carbon emissions directly. Indirectly, through our investments and our clients, if you will, we are participating in climate change reduction strategies by some of our underwriting activities. A couple weeks ago, where we worked with a demand side management of electricity consumption firm, which we took public, and I've invested in that company. We've been investing in wind farms across the globe, in India and in Japan. And so the answer is yes, all of the business implications of a for-profit company, we have to address sustainability, but we also have to make it a profitable venture. In terms of internally reducing our own footprint, we have a new program right now called, it's really a save the tree, it's really a save the money. I mean, you know, in some ways it's like money grows off of the trees, right? If you save paper, you're saving the trees, and we're also saving money by doing that. So all of Citibank and Smith Barney clients can now do all of their transactions and statement delivery electronically, so they no longer have to get a paper statement on a monthly or quarterly basis.
Yeah.
So we have, if you go to our website, citigroup.com, and you look at /environment, you can go and look at our citizenship report, which was just issued 2 weeks ago, with all of our GHG emission reporting and our GRI, the Global Reporting Initiative Standards reporting. And you'll find a lot of information there about that. Did you want to make
Want to make one additional comment. Also today, too, they just announced with that tree program that we planted 300,000 trees this last quarter by clients signing up for that. So that's a great benefit. And we've also been very involved, too, with microfinance, which not only helps alleviate poverty, but it helps alleviate environmental degradation. So we've been a leading sponsor of providing financing to microfinance, too.
Excellent. Yes, sir.
Well, one of the recent studies that I think is really interesting that has just come out was one that attempted to put a value on every tree in New York City. And they did a survey of all the trees in New York City and then put actually a dollar value on every single one. And those values were based on how much water those trees can prevent from going into the rivers and the ocean. And also on the values of the trees reducing energy. And I think that is something that is still evolving, like the way that we put value on natural things. But the fact is, I mean, the fact that you can't really swim in the water in New York City, even though we're surrounded by water, is really crazy. Like, it just, I think to anyone from Europe or anywhere else, yes. We have beaches, but for instance, but in terms of water quality, for instance, there are advisories issued after every combined sewage overflow that say, please don't swim on this day near this thing. And that's because raw sewage is essentially flowing into the water at those points. Obviously, it's not at every beach, but it's a huge problem in this city, and it's something that hasn't been adequately addressed. And green roofs and any kind of greenery in the city is the number one way to address that. But you're right, there's not a good way to put a dollar value on that. It's just important.
I was just at a conference in Pittsburgh the last couple of days and had a chance to talk to a couple of developers who are doing brownfield redevelopment and all sorts of mixed-use projects all over the country. And water is a big thing. Water is a big concern. And some developers have suggested to me that one important way in which they have tried to get their clients to talk about water and really consider water as just as important as energy is to really go beyond energy efficiency and stuff that's on the building level into the realm of regeneration. If we talk about wetland restoration and really talking about the building's engagement with the earth, that is the most effective way so far that the developers I've talked to have been able to engage them in terms of water issues, and to go beyond just, you know, managing stormwater and conserving water, but really to protect the water that's already there. Like groundwater replenishment is a huge one that a lot of developers hadn't considered before, but now everyone is on it at the moment, it seems like, it seems at least from this conference. All the good ones, right? And I think on that level, on that bigger real estate development level, the really engagement with the client and getting them to really be educated about ecological design rather than just sustainable design is a big driving force.
I think the question you pose goes to the essence of things. The answers are really difficult, and I suspect that we will need to have more than one tool in the policy kit to get there. So let me throw out two just hypotheticals. For energy use, whether it's buildings and electric consumption or gasoline for cars and other vehicles, I would propose that higher taxes to discourage consumption would make a lot of sense, and to make taxes more palatable and also more equitable for people. Two, for every dollar of additional revenue that comes in through, let's say, a carbon tax on gasoline, you reduce $1 in payroll taxes. So you find taxes, think about tax policy, the textbook version of tax policy. You tax behaviors you want to discourage, and you provide tax incentives for behaviors you want to support. That, however, would probably not be a good tool, let's say, for having an impact on drinking water consumption. I can't imagine a city or a society that says, sorry, you can't pay your drinking water tax, go buy Perrier instead. So in cases of absolutely life essential resources where we want to use them more wisely and use them more efficiently, the array of technology innovations and solutions, some of which have been laid out here, will probably work a lot better.
Just a question, though. I mean, your question is very good, and it makes me think that we need to think about the urban environment. It's an integrative system. And I wonder, I'm not familiar with this, are there very good, I'm going to call them models, perhaps conceptual or actually technical, kind of like the engineering model I was showing you that was put together by environmental engineers on the multimedia, multi-phase exposure for toxic chemical emissions. Is there really such a model out there combining, you know, the ecosystem of the building, well, I'll call it ecosystem of the building, and there are. Does anybody know? Okay. If they're not, we should have some.
I think we'll take one more question. Yes, in the back.
I'll cede the second question to my right. On the first question, so aluminum in terms of where do the emissions come from? Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. In the production. Right. And that's the point of supply chain thinking.
I don't have an easy answer for concrete. One of the things you can do is look for concrete with fly ash content, but again, that's an industrial byproduct, so it doesn't solve any of the VOC content problems. For things like rugs and paint, I can give you better answers. You can look at Green Seal, which certifies green building products for low VOC content. Also, the Carpet and Rug Institute has a lot of standards for VOC emittance of carpets, but in terms of the building materials like concrete and like aluminum, there, I don't believe. Do you have a comment to this?
The vacuum of aluminum is very high energy consumption, and it shifts around the globe wherever we get the best. So we had an upstate where the St. Lawrence Canal project was prepared to subsidize, but it's now going to Iceland where it taps into an energy renewable source, which is geothermal now. The other thing is connected, and once you produce the aluminum, the reuse cost is much, much less than doing, and the best source is aluminum cans. That's the highest value aluminum gets out here. But the other thing that nobody figures in, which maybe has to be looked at as an energy services sector, is what's the cost of then moving? Where should we be producing it? And that is Iceland, maybe because the top of the world is really an efficient place to service Europe and North America.
That's a great question. I think we're going to end it there. I have a few housekeeping items to report to you all, and then we'll be able to adjourn to the foyer there for some more refreshments. First of all, would like to thank Design 21 and 10 Cane Rum for their sponsor of those refreshments. And if you'd like to inquire about sponsoring or investing in the commercialization of any socially viable products, you can contact them or meet with Marissa Feinberg, who's here from that organization. I hope this was all very thought-provoking for everybody. It got you thinking about what you're doing in your own life as well as your own occupations. Would like to also thank Cooper Union for and Lena Imamura for hosting us. Also, I just wanted to point out that we have a variety of publications up on the tables there that detail a lot of the investment research that Citigroup Smith Barney has been doing in the area of climate change, real estate development, sustainability overall. And in that nature, in that spirit, I'd like to also call your attention to a program that we've been underwriting on the Sundance Channel called The Green. Last night's program was actually on sustainable building and highlighted William McDonough and Michael Brongart and some of their work. And there will be a variety of programs throughout the summer that you should tune into. The last but not least is our Sustainability Practice Network will be having an event in June that I think Michael Block wants to just say a word or so about.
The last event for the season before summer break, we're going to have a panel discussion with Michael Block, who's going to talk about
Great, thank you, Michael. And just one point of clarification, if people did not have a chance to grab the climate consequences, investment implications of a changing climate, which really goes across all industrial sectors on the impacts of climate change, you can sign up for the publication up there or leave your business card and we can send that to you. And any of the other publications that were scoffed up by everybody, if you want any of them, just leave your name or business card. Thank you very much for attending again, and it was a great evening. What's that? Yes, good to see you, Sam.
How are you?
Good, I owe you a return. But you see what I'm doing, so we'll do another one.